Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
I'm Momo.
And this is Monstrous. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. Okay, so this was our Halloween night episode.
Okay, so we're a few days late.
Yep. It was a little crazy.
A little?
Each of the boys had a school dance. We had Halloween night. I went all day with no sleep.
That wasn't fun.
Because I worked the night before. So, it's late.
Better late than never.
Right. It's a good one. So Friday we closed out spooky season.
Actually, today we're closing out spooky season.
Well, yeah, but Friday officially because it was Halloween. Okay. So this was our Halloween night episode.
Okay. So we're a few days late.
Yep. It was a little crazy.
A little.
Each of the boys had a school dance. We had Halloween night. I went all day with no sleep.
That wasn't fun.
Because I worked the night before. So, it's late.
Better late than never.
Right. It's a good one. So, Friday, we closed out spooky season.
Actually, today we're closing out spooky season.
Well, yeah. But Friday, officially, because it was Halloween. This would have been our final Friday episode. So, starting next week, we go back to only one episode a week. On Mondays.
Yay.
For now. And even though it's late, we wanted to close the spooky season out with a bang. Or perhaps a chilling rattle. We couldn't let Halloween pass, late or not, without diving into the case that truly changed Halloween forever. Because this is such a special occasion, you are not going to get just one case for this episode. You are getting a late Halloween true crime double feature.
Ooh.
It's two chilling cases with one shared sinister moniker.
Somebody died.
The Candyman.
Oh. Should I break out in song now with the Candyman?
No.
Oh.
Different kind of Candyman. Now, when you hear the name Candyman during Halloween, you might think of the frightening tradition of saying his name five times in the mirror. Or nowadays, you might think of the movie. But the real-life men who earned this nickname are far more terrifying than any movie or urban legend, and their crimes weren't confined to a single spooky night. While these two stories did occur at different times and under different circumstances, they are forever tied together by this sinister shared moniker. So the month is October. The air is cool, the leaves are falling, and the stores are filled with bags of pre-packaged candy. For one night, the line between reality and fantasy is blurred by costumes and candlelight, making Halloween one of the most beloved and oldest rituals of American life. But for millions of parents across the country, Halloween is not defined by joy. It is actually defined by fear. A deep, anxious vigilance that requires every single piece of candy to be checked, every costume to be double-layered, and every stranger to be treated with suspicion. That fear has a name, and it is the legacy of the Candyman. So we begin this story today asking what makes a monster become a moniker, how a simple, sweet name could become forever synonymous with evil. The answer, as we will see, is a double tragedy. This is a story of betrayal, darkness, and the permanent destruction of trust. It is a story of two separate men in the same metro area of Houston, Texas, who earned the same chilling nickname, the Candyman. The first used candy as a lure to commit mass murder, shattering the trust between a child and their neighbor. The second used candy as a weapon, poisoning the entire spirit of the holiday for a cheap life insurance payout. Now, before we get to the notorious figure who forever poisoned the tradition of trick-or-treating, we first have to address the other Candyman, a killer whose sheer volume of victims places him among the worst murderers in Texas history, Dean Arnold Correll. So long before O'Brien's act of suburban evil, another Candyman haunted the streets of Houston. But this one didn't hide behind smiles or a church title. Dean Correll was the kind of predator who operated in plain sight. He was wrapped in charm, sugar, and secrecy. He worked at his family's candy factory, literally handing out sweets to neighborhood kids. To them, he was generous. To their parents, harmless. But behind closed doors, he was luring teenage boys into a nightmare that would claim at least 28 known victims.
Dang!
The fact that he was nicknamed the Candyman long before O'Brien shows how deeply those two words have come to symbolize something sinister in American folklore. Innocence turned inside out. And when Correll's crimes finally came to light, it wasn't through police work or forensic breakthroughs. It was through his own accomplice. A teenage boy who had helped him find victims, lure them in, and ultimately dig their graves.
Yeah, with a few bucks, you can get a teenager to do just about anything.
Yeah, I mean, honestly. Dean Correll wasn't the kind of killer who struck once and disappeared. He operated over years, hiding his crimes behind a mask of small-town kindness. He handed out sweets to local kids, worked in his family's candy factory, invited teenagers to his apartment to hang out, play music, and drink beer. To the outside world, he was harmless, generous, even likable. But behind those closed doors, Correll was orchestrating one of the most horrifying serial murder sprees in American history. With the help of two teenage accomplices, he abducted, tortured, and killed at least 28 boys between 1970 and 1973. The sheer brutality of it stunned even the most hardened investigators. His crimes were so unimaginable that when the story broke, reporters struggled to find the language that could contain it. This was no simple act of violence. It was sustained, organized evil. And just like O'Brien, Correll used something innocent. Candy, to lure his victims in. Sweetness, masking rot. So Correll's story is one of meticulous deception. It's the story of how an organized, seemingly upstanding citizen of the 1970s used a reputation of childhood innocence to lure dozens of boys to their deaths. It is also the story of how systematic failure in law enforcement allowed a monster to operate for 3 years without fear of consequence. So, Mama, if you're comfy over there.
I am.
And you're ready.
Let's do it.
Then we're going to descend into the heart of Houston mass murders and investigate the double life of a killer who used sweetness as his most terrifying weapon. So to understand how this Candyman earned his name, we have to go back to where it all began. This story begins in Houston, Texas, specifically in the working class neighborhood of Houston Heights during the 1970s.
Dude, I was just a teenager in the 70s.
My bad, I put the wrong year there. So Houston Heights in the late 1970s was a pocket of blue-collar America. Narrow streets, corner stores, and modest homes baking under the Texas sun. So picture it. Houston in the early 1970s. The air is heavy with humidity, even in October. Mosquitoes buzzing under flickering street lights. Kids still walked home barefoot from football practice. They chased ice cream trucks and stray dogs. It was a place where neighbors waved at each other, sat on porches after dark, unbothered. Where doors were often left unlocked, and Halloween wasn't just a night for costumes, it was a night for community. Parents handed out homemade treats, popcorn balls, caramel apples, bags of loose candy. No one questioned what might be inside them. The idea that candy could be dangerous was unthinkable. But beneath that...
Yeah, we never, when we were growing kids, you know, we never inspected our candy or... You know,
right? You,
apples or popcorn balls.
Always checked our candy.
Yeah, well, yeah, because times were different by the time you guys were born.
Yep, when we checked the boys' candy every year.
But when me and your aunts were kids, you know, we'd eat popcorn balls that one of the neighbors made, and or apples and oranges, never thinking.
Yep.
you know, or candy partially unwrapped. We didn't think, just open fish, open it, pop it in your mouth. You know, that's one good little fat girls. But, you know, we never worried about that stuff when we were kids.
Right. And we even do it with the boys. If it doesn't have a label on it, if it's partially open, goes in the trash. Don't eat it.
Just can't. Nowadays, it just blows my mind how people can do that to children.
Right.
I mean, some of these children may need some discipline, but not bad.
No. And even if we do like parades or anything, then the boys want a piece. We look at it and make sure, well, you've seen that.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
But it's like, it just blows my mind,
mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure it's a lot of your older listeners can relate to that.
Yeah. That like stuff like this is why you can't even take homemade goods into your kids' class anymore.
Right. They have to be store-bought. Uh-huh. But what they don't stop and realize, store-bought can be messed with too.
Well, yeah. But typically, so like the boys' school, if say I was to go get cupcakes, it's like the sticker still has to be intact.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It can't, same like it can't be unopened.
The Becky's kids.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be Sarah now. She's the only one left in elementary school.
Right.
But it's just.
It's just crazy to think
it
about.
It is crazy. Because I remember baking cookies for your guys'.
Yeah. Yeah, when classes. I was in school, you baked cookies and
cupcakes
stuff like that all the time.
And send them to your school.
Baking,
you
know, cookies.
Because your mom and Jason were working.
Mm-hmm.
So Mama would do it because I had you guys after school anyway.
Right.
You know, or.
Becky used to make that strawberry thing for my newspaper class every week.
Oh, the strawberry cream cheese pie?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It just. You know, we just never.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. Of course, we were living in a small town
right.
then, too.
I see.
And everybody knew everybody.
And this still happens today. It really does. I seen on Facebook this morning. I hadn't had a chance to tell you yet. And it's a few hours from here. But a parent found a sewing needle in one of their kids' Twix bars that they got Friday night.
Jesus.
Yep. I had to look and see how far away it was and make sure it wasn't here.
And that makes me understand why Becky and their friend group just throw a Halloween party for the kids.
Well, they don't even do door-to-door trick-or-treating there anymore.
Huh.
It's called trunk-or-treats now.
But I understand it now.
Right.
Better because of all the craziness.
Right. Like, I get it, but it's also like, it's kind of like a rite of passage through childhood. I get it. Fully understand it, which is why we check the boys' candy.
Well, trunk-or-treating is like trick-or-treating anyway.
Yeah.
But it's a more safer, more safer control.
And there back home, they don't do door-to-door trick-or-treating. I don't think they do it anywhere. It's all trunk-or-treats there.
I think it is too. Well, down there, so it's so crazy anyway.
Right.
So.
But yeah, that's like, I get it because we check the boys' candy. Every year, Halloween, anytime we do parades, anything like that, that we didn't give
them
the candy.
And it's a shame. And it's a shame. It really is. It just
makes
me thank God I grew up when I did.
Right. It shouldn't be that way.
Because I got the experiences that these kids, and even you.
Yeah,
because
you guys didn't start checking my candy until I was older.
Yeah, that's when it started getting crazy.
Yep. It's just, it's.
We heard about those kids being poisoned there in one of the big cities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, nope, we're done.
Yep. It's such a bad time.
You know, and
that's why we take the boys trick-or-treating every year, because we both had that.
You got to have that experience.
Right. It's such a different
experience. Could be your last year with Logan.
Yeah.
Because he's getting older.
Mm-hmm.
But even teenagers are still trick-or-treating.
Yeah.
I'd rather see a teenager trick-or-treating than out causing hate and discontent.
Right, exactly.
And getting drunk and doing something stupid.
Yep. Yep.
You know?
But
I'm okay with that.
He may want to go out and be with his friends. Rather than go with us and his little brother.
Well, no, I get that. I get that. No, I remember I have a little sister too.
Right. So it's kind of, this might be Loki's last year.
But then again, you get surprises.
Right. Yeah.
Because I've learned never underestimate that child.
Nope. You never know what he's going to do.
No.
With the other one of them.
Nope. Like this morning, prime example with that one.
Right. So funny. Okay. Anyway, sorry guys. We went on a
tangent.
Right. Sorry. Okay. So underneath that warm suburban glow, something unspeakable was happening in a quiet home, in quiet homes and rented storage sheds. something that would rewrite every parent's sense of safety. This was the perfect environment that someone like Dean Correll could thrive on. Here you would find the Correll Candy Company, a small family-owned establishment that specialized in Polly Pops, a popular kind of individually wrapped lollipop. And here you would meet its face, Dean Arnold Correll. Correll was born on Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1939 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. His childhood
was... He was an old dude by the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I know you picture a young guy, but he wasn't. So his childhood was defined by an instability that perhaps shaped his later need for absolute control. His parents divorced, they remarried, and then permanently separated by the time he was 14.
That's rough.
Yeah. Forcing him and his mother, Mary, to live a transient life in Houston. He was a shy, sensitive child, overly reactive to criticism, and his history of rheumatic fever left him with a heart murmur, exempting him from competitive sports. This combination of physical isolation and emotional fragility may have been the thing that contributed to the extreme sense of entitlement that he would later express through his violence. Neighbors later said that Dean was polite, almost painfully so. He mowed lawns, fixed wiring for free, waved to the mailman. No one around him saw a monster. He kept to himself, but was known for his precision. Every tool in his garage lined up like a soldier. When something broke, he didn't rest until it was fixed. Control, they said later, was his love language. That control seeped into everything. How he spoke, how he dressed, and eventually how he decided who lived and who didn't. Control would become his obsession, the antidote of a chaotic childhood. Every piece of his adult life, from his spotless apartment to his daily routines, was designed to reinforce that sense of order. But underneath that control was resentment toward authority, toward rejection, and toward the vulnerability of being powerless as a child. That resentment metastasized into something far darker, a belief that dominance equaled safety. Despite this background, Correll built a perfect, unimpeachable facade. He was known to all in the neighborhood as the Candyman and the Pied Piper. This nickname wasn't a joke. It was earned. Working at the family candy company, Correll would regularly hand out free sweets, sometimes even going into the community to distribute them. To local children and their parents, he was harmless, friendly, and trustworthy. The quintessential good neighbor, this reputation became his single most effective murder weapon. Correll's adult life, at least on the surface, was one of stability. He served in the Army from 1964 to 1965. During which time he reportedly had his first homosexual encounters. Now, before receiving a hardship discharge to return home. By the early 1970s, he was working as a dedicated electrician for the Houston Lighting and Power Company, which is also known as HLMP, even earning a promotion to become supervisor. It is worth noting that while Correll remained in Houston, his mother moved out of the state to open a new candy shop in Colorado, which left him completely unsupervised. This was not a drifter or a stereotypical outcast. This was an organized, employed adult with a routine and a reliable cover story. However, acquaintances noted the subtle, chilling duality of his persona. At times, he was jovial, childlike, and even earned the nickname Deanie Weenie. And at other times, he could be agitated, chain-smoking, and intensely serious. His ability to operate with this split personality provided the perfect cover for his secret life. Correll's sexual interests focused exclusively on young males, and he began by establishing transactional relationships. To facilitate this, he had installed a pool table in the back of the candy factory, turning it into a constant hangout for local boys. Tragically, Correll's mother was informed by a teenage employee that Correll had made sexual advances towards him. Rather than seeking help or alerting authorities, she simply fired the boy.
That's just wrong.
Mm-hmm. This decision allowed Correll to continue his predatory behavior, fostering a sense of impunity that would prove to be fatal. Now, the city was booming. Oil money, new highways, rapid suburban growth. But this growth came with cracks, and kids slipped through them. Runaway culture was rampant in the early 70s. Youth shelters were few, and police often treated missing boys as nuisances rather than emergencies. It was a time when families trusted authority without question, and when predators like Correll could hide in plain sight behind a smile in a small candy business. Now, going back to the 60s for just a minute, in 1967, Correll had befriended a 12-year-old boy named David Owen Brooks. Brooks came from a fractured home and desperately sought a sense of belonging coming to... Jesus Christ. A sense of belonging. Coming to view Correll as a much-needed, quote, substitute father figure, Correll expertly exploited this vulnerability, starting with small gestures such as gifts, cash, and gradually escalated to transactional sexual encounters by 1969. Correll was creating a dependent, indebted relationship. And by the time the Correll Candy Company closed in 1970, Dean Correll's need for control and sadism had completely overwhelmed his paid transactional patterns. He no longer simply wanted sexual encounters. He needed absolute, total possession. The simple, non-fatal explosion phase was over. Now, the murder spree was ready to begin. Dean Correll had moved past petty exploitation. He now needed two things: an isolated place to operate and a steady supply of victims. In the later half of 1970, Dean Correll moved from Houston Heights to an apartment in Yorktown and transitioned fully from a sexual predator to an organized serial killer. He solved his supply problem by turning his relationship with the now 17-year-old David Brooks into one of criminal partnership. Now remember, they met when David was only 12. So for 5 years, he's been grooming him and preparing him to be his assistant, with the lack of a better term, shall I say. So Correll needed a constant stream of young males who wouldn't be missed, and needed a scout who knew the local boys of Houston Heights. So he offered Brooks a stunning financial incentive, $200 for every boy delivered.
Back then, that's a lot of money for a teenage boy.
1970, this was an astronomical amount, equivalent to over $1,600 today. Brooks, driven by the massive payments, accepted. The murder operation was officially underway. The first two known victims was James Glass and David Yates, both teens, vanished in late 1970 after being lured by Brooks. James was just 14, a soft-spoken kid who loved comic books and dreamed of becoming a mechanic. David was 15, outgoing, always cracking jokes in class. They told friends they were heading to the beach that day, but they never made it. To police, they were runaways. To their families, they were boys who never came home. Brooks confessed to assisting in the abduction and later burial of the victims, though he consistently maintained that he never participated in the actual killing itself. By 1971, the operation gained its second, more active, and far more deeply corrupted member, Elmer Wayne Henley Jr. Henley Jr., a 14-year-old high school dropout, was introduced to Correll by Brooks. Like Brooks, Henley came from a dysfunctional home. His father had been abusive and violent, and he admired Correll, the hardworking electrician. Correll systematically groomed Henley over 2 years, first paying him for petty crimes, then allowing him to drive Correll's beloved car, creating a sense of indebtedness and trust. To further coerce him, Correll convinced Henley he was running a massive, lucrative, quote, white slavery ring to sell teenage boys as, quote, house boys to wealthy clients. This elaborate lie served as a psychological tool to normalize the act of luring and kidnapping. Correll then deployed a devastating psychological weapon against Henley, who had dreams of becoming a minister and read the Bible daily. Grell launched constant psychological attacks against Henley's faith to get him to shift his world. The ultimate psychological break came when Henley participated in his first assisted murder. This was of Mark Scott, who was 16. During the act, Henley later claimed he thought God would strike him dead. When he wasn't instantly punished, his entire moral compass failed. Grell used this moment of confusion to convince Henley he had crossed a permanent line of no return and was now doomed, forcing him into active compliance. Henley's participation soon escalated to both luring and actively participating in the torture and murder of their victims. The psychological contrast between the two accomplices was stark. David Brooks, who received the higher cash payment and was Carell's first recruit, became outwardly possessive and almost robotically cooperative during his time with Carell. He was described by investigators as emotionless during questioning, as if his conscience had been entirely hollowed out. While Elmer Wayne Henley Jr., however, operated from a place of frantic, coerced obedience, often visibly distraught after a murder, but terrified of Carell's wrath. This dual approach to coercion, cold financial bribery, and crushing psychological dominance ensured Carell always had a steady, if broken, supply chain. So no matter what, he always had someone bringing victims to him.
Yeah, he did.
If one bowed out, he had the other one. Yeah. Meanwhile, as the death toll continued to climb, quietly, Carell's operation was protected by massive systematic failure. Because remember, he has 28 known victims, but this would be an extremely long episode if we went through every single one of those.
Yeah, it would.
I would love to, but unfortunately, we just can't. Because that's a lot. So anyone who wants to know their names, you can find those. 1970s Houston, the term runaway became a convenient label that let cases quietly close. Most of Carell's victims came from lower-income families, parents who worked long hours, who couldn't afford to post missing person notices or pressure investigators. Police often assumed that troubled boys from these neighborhoods simply fled from home or joined the hippie scene.
The hippies got blamed for everything.
I know. The result was catastrophic. The disappearance of nearly 30 boys didn't trigger an investigation. It triggered apathy. Parents filed missing person reports for their sons, but the Houston Police Department consistently logged them as runaways or delinquents, particularly if they came from the working-class Houston Heights neighborhood. These boys, tragically labeled as disposable, were never properly investigated, which allowed Carell's operation to continue without fear of detection. And in that silence, in that failure, a monster found room to grow. Carell's crimes were acts of sexual sadism, possession, and absolute control. His final operational base was his apartment at 2020 Lamar Street in Pasadena. This was the Chamber of Horrors, a space meticulously prepared for torture. In the bedroom, the centerpiece was a custom-made 8-foot by 3-foot plywood board with built-in restraints and manacles.
Dang.
This torture board was designed to hold victims for prolonged periods, sometimes even days, for sexual assault and abuse before they were ultimately strangled or shot with a .22 caliber pistol. When the victims were deceased, Grell would manage the disposal with surgical precision. He even rented a specific unit at the Southwest Boat Storage Shed, signing paperwork under the pretense of storing his electrician equipment. Furthermore, Grell ordered his accomplice to regularly acquire tools for the gruesome logistics. Shovels, rolls of thick plastic sheeting, bags of lime to suppress decay and odor, and rope. The chilling reality of the Houston mass murders is that it was a highly organized assembly line operation, protected by a cloak of normalcy and the indifference of the very system charged with protecting the city's youth. Carell's crimes weren't just murders. there were rituals of control. Every act seemed designed to erase humanity from his victims and feed his obsession with power. He built what investigators later called a torture board, which is what I just described. So after the victims were tied down, subjected to unthinkable pain, and then killed, they were then buried in shallow graves across the Houston area. The calm with which Correll maintained his double life, a friendly neighborhood figure by day, a sadistic killer by night, forces us to confront one of the most chilling truths about humanity. Evil doesn't always look like a monster. Sometimes it looks like someone who smiles at you from across the street. Correll's story, while separated by time and motive from O'Brien's, carries that same underlying dread. The fear that the threat is not the stranger in the mask, but the person we've already let in. What makes Dean Correll's story uniquely disturbing isn't just the number of victims. It's the quiet precision behind his cruelty. He didn't kill impulsively. He planned. He built a system. Correll's crimes were an extension of his need for absolute dominance. His victims were chosen, groomed, manipulated, and then discarded. And perhaps most horrifying of all, he made others complicit. He turned two teenage boys into his helpers, blurring the line between victim and perpetrator until the entire world he built was soaked in moral decay. When the truth finally came out, it wasn't through confession or discovery. It was through revolt. One of his accomplices, in a final act of defiance, turned on him and pulled the trigger. Correll died instantly. The monster was gone. But the horror he left behind seeped into the soil of Houston forever. In many ways, Correll's death didn't end the story. It preserved it. A dark reminder that sometimes the people who seem safest are the ones who hide the deepest shadows. Now, the three-year operation came to a violent and sudden end. And like I said, not by the hands of law enforcement, but by one of the accomplices' terrified acts of self-preservation. The reign of the Candyman ended on the night of August 7th, 1973. Correll Henley and two of Henley's teenage friends, a male and a 15-year-old female named Rhonda Williams, were at Correll's Pasadena home, drinking and huffing paint fumes. Correll's strict control began to break down when the two friends passed out. Correll bound all three. Correll was reportedly infuriated that Henley had brought a girl to the house and announced his plan to assault and kill all three of them. Henley, in a desperate struggle, managed to free himself, secure Correll's .22 caliber pistol, and shot Correll six times in a frantic moment of self-defense, killing the serial killer instantly.
Dang!
Correll's death was a violent end to a three-year rampage. Six shots. That's all it took to end 3 years of horror. For the first time in years, the monster was gone. But killing Correll didn't end that nightmare. It only opened the door to what lay beneath Houston's surface. The walls of that small Pasadena home, filled with candy wrappers and extension cords, were about to spill secrets Houston had never imagined. Henley, moments after the shocking killing, ran to a nearby phone and called the police. The scene was quickly swarmed by authorities and media. In a moment that defined the chaos and horror, a KPRC TV reporter allowed Henley to use the car's radio phone. What followed was broadcast live to the city. Henley's voice distraught, declaring, "Mama, I killed Dean." He confessed that he felt he owed the victims' families the truth. And his immediate shocking revelation began the undoing of Correll's secret life. The lengthy confession led to the immediate revelation of a horror the city could not have imagined. Over the next 5 days, Henley and Brooks led authorities to three major burial sites between August 8th and August 13th, 1973. The first dig site was a dusty boat shed off Silver Bell Street. Investigators opened the door to find a rush of hot air and the faint, unmistakable stench of decay. Beneath the dirt floor, they unearth one body, then another, and another. Reporters described seasoned detectives turning away, unable to keep their composure. Some vomited, others wept openly. One officer would later say it was like standing at the edge of hell with shovel in hand.
Damn.
By week's end, the number of bodies climbed into the double digits. The city watched in disbelief as television screens showed rows of evidence bags and chalk markers scattered across what looked like an ordinary shed. The realization came slowly, painfully. This wasn't the work of a transient killer. It was systematic, planned, and in plain sight. The most ghastly discovery was the Southwest Boat Storage Shed in Houston. Under the dirt floor of the unit Correll had rented under the guise of an electrician, police found the remains of 17 boys, individually wrapped in plastic and covered in lime powder. Additional mass graves were located at remote areas, including Lake Sam Rayburn and High Island Beach. The final tally, a minimum of 29 victims, aged 13 to 20, whose disappearances had all been dismissed. The sheer volume of these discoveries instantly classified the Houston mass murders as the worst example of serial murder in U.S. history at that time. The conditions of the bodies presented a forensic nightmare. Due to the rapid decomposition in the Texas heat and Correll's use of lime, many remains were beyond standard identification methods like fingerprinting or dental records. Investigators were forced to painstakingly cross-reference fragments of evidence, clothing remnants, length of rope, and a few preserved bones, with the sparse, often poorly documented, missing persons files. It was an investigation based on piecing together ignored clues, a haunting effort to name the dead years after they had been murdered. The case attracted massive national attention, further exposing the horrifying police failure. The media descended on Houston, dubbing it the mass murder capital of the world, a title that compounded the city's shame. The terror was immediate. Parents who had dismissed their neighbors' missing children as delinquents were now paralyzed with the thought that their own sons could have been among the lost. The subsequent public outcry was so immense that it forced an immediate critical overhaul of the Houston Police Department's policies on handling missing minors, ensuring no missing persons report would be so carelessly dismissed again. The initial critique of the Houston Police Department's policies for failing to connect the missing persons cases was swift and brutal. This investigation continues to this day. The sheer scale of the crimes and the condition of the bodies complicated identification. Even with the advancements of modern forensic science, the remains of one known victim, known only as John Houston Doe, 1973, remain unidentified.
Dang!
His clothing and a mild form of spina bifida are all that can be used to identify him. And forensic efforts continue to give this last lost boy his name back. The killer was dead, but the horrors he inflicted did not end there. For the families of the victims, the fight for justice was just beginning. So Dean Correll dead, but his accomplices still had to face justice. Both David Brooks and Elmer Wayne Henley Jr. were convicted. Brooks received a life sentence for one count of murder and died in prison in 2020. Henley was convicted of 6 murders and is currently serving 6 consecutive life sentences. Due to Texas sentencing laws at the time, both of these men became eligible for parole after a relatively short period. This created a cycle of unending trauma for the victims' families. James and Elaine Dremala, the parents of 13-year-old Santon Dremala, who was Correll's last known victim, have had to fight a decades-long battle against every single parole review, including over 25 attempts by Henley to seek release. For the Dramalas and other families, the pursuit of justice has become a reoccurring agonizing ritual that ensures the pain of the Candyman is never truly put to rest. The collective impact was devastating. The revelation of this organized industrial-scale murder operation carried out by a respectable electrician and his teenage accomplices sent a paralyzing shockwave through Houston. The city's fundamental trust in its neighbors and institutions was irreparably broken. Before Dean Carell, Candy was a symbol of childhood. Sweet, simple, harmless. After Dean Carell, the word itself became tainted. Parents no longer saw candy as a treat, but instead as a lure. Halloween, a night built on trust between neighbors, now carried an edge of fear. And while Carell may have died in 1973, his legacy of dread didn't die with him. It lingered in every parent's warning, every flashlight lit trick-or-treat, every nervous glance at a stranger's smile. And as Houston mourned its lost sons, the funerals stretched for weeks. Tiny caskets, rows of grieving parents, and unanswered questions. The city changed after this. Parents locked doors that had never been locked before. Houston's easy southern charm dimmed a little, replaced by something harder: suspicion, fear, and vigilance. And as the nation read the headlines, one question lingered. How many other monsters like Dean Carell were hiding behind ordinary smiles? And what the country didn't yet know was that another Candyman was preparing to strike. One whose weapon wasn't a lure, but the candy itself. And that
was wild.
First case for this episode.
That was wild.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that was going on when I was a kid.
You didn't expect all that, did you?
No, because we lived in California at the
right
time. So,
right. You know. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
So every generation has that one urban legend that seeps into the collective consciousness. A story whispered on playgrounds, repeated by cautious parents, and amplified by the nightly news until it feels like truth. In the 1970s and 80s, that legend was the Halloween sadist. Razor blades and apples, pins and candy bars, poisoned sweets slipped into plastic pumpkins under the cover of night. The fear was electric, spreading like static from one household to the next. Police departments began scanning candy with x-rays. Churches hosted safe trunk-or-treat events long before the term existed. Parents hovered behind their kids like Secret Service agents on suburban sidewalks. But underneath the panic was something deeper, the sense that innocence itself had been compromised. Halloween, once a night for mischief and imagination, had become a night of suspicion. People began to believe the danger wasn't in the darkness beyond their porch light. It was right there in the candy bowl. So for this one, we're going to stay in Houston, Texas, but we're going to move forward by just a year to Halloween night, 1974. The city was still trying to scrub the darkness left by Dean Carell. The fear of the Pied Piper was still fresh in every parent's mind. They were vigilant against strangers. They were wary of men offering rides. They looked for the lure. But the next Candyman understood that the biggest weakness in a time of widespread fear is trust. He knew that if the parents were looking outside, they wouldn't be looking inside. So our first Candyman used candy as a cover for his crimes. Our second, though, would use candy as a weapon itself, unleashing a form of fear that was far more intimate, far more pervasive, and which would destroy the innocent ritual of trick-or-treating for generations. This is the story of Ronald Clark O'Brien, the candy killer, or the man who killed Halloween, and the crime that forever taught America to fear the treat. So Halloween has always carried a certain thrill with it, a night when the world blurs just enough to let in a little danger. But in the late 1900s, that thrill turned into genuine fear. Across neighborhoods in the U.S., the whisper spread. Someone was putting razor blades in apples, pins in chocolate bars, and poison in candy. It didn't matter that there wasn't enough evidence. The idea alone was enough to take root. Local news reports began warning parents. Police departments rolled out public service announcements urging everyone to check their candy. Some hospitals even started offering free x-rays for trick-or-treaters' halls. By the time Ronald Clark O'Brien's crime came to light, the fear had already metastasized, but his act gave it flesh and blood. What had been rumor became proof. He turned a decades-old whisper into something tangible. The monster everyone had been warned about was real, and he looked like a father walking his kids door to door. Halloween would never again be a night of harmless mischief. From then on, it carried a shadow, one that would linger in every living room and candy bucket for generations to come. Ronald O'Brien wasn't some mysterious stranger lurking in the shadows. He was a man next door, a church deacon, a father, the kind of person you'd never expect to be capable of something so monstrous. And that's part of what's made his crime so haunting. He weaponized trust. Neighbors remembered him as polite, though distant. His coworkers said he always seemed to be chasing something. A new job, a quick fix, a shortcut out of debt. Beneath the veneer of the suburban dad was a man sinking fast. His financial troubles weren't just inconvenient, they were catastrophic. So, when investigators learned that O'Brien had recently taken out multiple life insurance policies on his children, the story shifted from tragedy to horror. It wasn't random evil. It was planned, cold, calculated. A man who used the guise of a beloved holiday to disguise premeditated murder. It's the kind of crime that rewires how people think about trust, not just on holiday, but every day after. Ronald O'Brien didn't fit the image of a killer. That's what made him so terrifying. He was the kind of man who could sit beside you at church or wave as you pulled into your driveway. He had a respectable job, a family, a home in the suburbs, all the trappings of normalcy. But behind those closed doors, the walls were cracking. O'Brien was drowning in debt. He was months behind on car payments, on the edge of losing his house, and desperate for a way out. He wasn't plotting a random act of violence. He was planning an escape, one that came at the cost of his own child's life. When he handed his son a pixie stick, he wasn't a man caught in a moment of madness. He was cold, calculated, intentional. And that's what makes his crime so haunting. It wasn't committed in rage or confusion. It was methodical. He didn't just kill for money. He weaponized the one thing every child trusted most, their Halloween candy. And in doing so, he shattered something that can never fully be repaired. The innocence of a holiday built on joy and imagination. So, it's October 31st, 1974, and we are once again in the Houston metropolitan area, specifically in the neighboring suburb of Pasadena, Texas. Just 1 year and 2 months after the horrifying discovery of the Houston mass murders, the atmosphere for Halloween was thick with caution.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Because, I mean, this is just a year later after all of that.
Went down.
Yeah.
Crazy, I tell you.
So parents at the time were extremely cautious. They were checking their children's candies with flashlights, but the neighborhood tradition was a suburb thing, and the children were still out doing what kids do on Halloween. Ronald Clark O'Brien was a 30-year-old man preparing to take his own two children, 8-year-old Timothy and 5-year-old Elizabeth, trick-or-treating with a neighbor, Jim Bates, and his son.
Babies.
Guys. On the surface, Ron O'Brien was the definition of respectability and the American dream. He was a clean-cut optical technician, a family man, and a deacon at the Second Baptist Church. He worked hard to cultivate an image of financial success and community leadership, constantly talking up his investments and business plans to anyone who would listen. But it was all a careful, fragile facade. Behind the expensive clothes and the talk of wealth, O'Brien was utterly and hopelessly drowning in a secret financial crisis. His long history of poor business decisions and failed ventures, from a chain of optical stores that never materialized to a perpetual inability to hold down a stable job, had left him deeply in debt facing repossession, bankruptcy, and foreclosure. His total debts were estimated to be nearly $100,000.
Dang.
An astronomical sum for the time.
Excuse me.
Largely consisting of high-interest loans that were past due. The facade wasn't just cracking. It was collapsing. O'Brien was facing imminent financial ruin, with creditors calling the house daily and final notices stacking up. His financial recklessness was compounded by a manipulative personality. He had been fired from over 6 different jobs in the most recent years, often leaving his employers in chaos. To O'Brien, the solution was not hard work. It was a desperate gamble. His biggest, most liquid assets were not his business holdings, but his children. This was no sudden thought. Months earlier, he had attempted to take out a $40,000 policy on Timothy. But the company would only approve a smaller amount. Just days before Halloween, he secured $10,000 worth of life insurance policies on both Timothy and Elizabeth, which, when combined with older policies, totaled approximately $20,000 for each child. He knew these policies would allow him to stave off his creditors and keep up his carefully constructed image. The premiums had been paid just 1 week before the crime, making the timing devastatingly calculated. Crucially, his wife, Danine, I believe that's how you say it, remained completely unaware that her husband had insured the lives of their 2 small children. So she had no idea that he had gotten life insurance on their kids. Yeah.
Well, yeah, because you can do it without anybody knowing.
Mm-hmm. So she's just going on about her life. No clue.
Because see, back in those days, the children weren't issued a Social Security card until they were 18 or 16 when they could start working.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because I got mine at 16.
Huh.
So you didn't need it.
Right.
Huh.
So as the group set out that evening into the humid, darkening streets, O'Brien wasn't thinking about fun or community. He was thinking about money. And he had a plan to get it, using the cover of fear already cast by the previous Candyman, Dean Correll. The night began innocently enough. Ron O'Brien, Jim Bates, and their children, Timothy, Elizabeth, and Jim's son, began their trick-or-treating route. They hit the normal houses, chatting easily, the children excited by the ritual. The first hint of something unusual occurred when the group approached a house that appeared empty. The porch lights were off and no one answered the door. Jim Bates had turned to leave, but O'Brien insisted they wait. He mentioned that it was the only house on the block they hadn't visited yet. After a minute, O'Brien claimed that a hand had suddenly appeared from a slightly open door, dropping 5 pieces of candy, large 21-inch long pixie sticks, into his children's bags, before the hand quickly retreated and the door silently closed. There was not standard dim store candies. They were specialty sweets. Investigators would later note that the ends of the paper tubes had been carefully unsealed and contents tampered with and then restapled. O'Brien then turned to the group and distributed the 5 pieces of candy. He gave 1 to Timothy, 1 to Elizabeth, 1 to Jim's Bates' son, and insisted that the last 2 be given to 2 different neighborhood children he knew, brothers, later on that night. The choice of the 5 victims, seemingly random, was a sinister strategy designed to make the source of the poison untraceable and to reinforce the idea that a random, malevolent stranger was responsible. A stranger O'Brien would later describe as having hairy arms and a deep voice. The group then cut their outing short when a light drizzle began to fall, and they headed back to the O'Brien home. Shortly after returning, Timothy, still in his costume, asked his father if he could eat 1 of the large pixie sticks. O'Brien, playing the role of the caring father, told his son that he could have just 1, but warned that the powdered sugar inside was packed tightly and he might need help to get it out. O'Brien stood by as Timothy struggled to open the sealed paper tube. To help, O'Brien allegedly used his finger to loosen the powdered substance inside. This simple action would become a point of agonizing contention later. But in that moment, Timothy lifted the paper straw to his lips and began to eat a pixie stick.
Damn.
The effect was instantaneous and horrific. Timothy, who had taken 2 large swallows of the candy, immediately complained that it tasted bitter. It had a strange and burning metallic flavor. He quickly ran to the sink, drinking water, trying to wash his mouth out. Within minutes, he began to vomit violently. He convulsed and hyperventilated. His mother rushed him to the bathroom. O'Brien, the smooth, calculated deacon, was suddenly a frantic father. He helped his wife rush Timothy to the car and drove to the hospital, which wasn't far. By the time they reached the emergency room at the Bay Shore Medical Center, Timothy O'Brien was barely breathing. He had been poisoned with cyanide.
Oh my God.
The cyanide was attacking his system on a cellular level, preventing his cells from getting oxygen and distributing it throughout his body. So he was desperately struggling for air. He suffered from a massive seizure right there in the hospital corridor. Doctors attempted desperately to stabilize the 8-year-old using a crash cart and every known medical intervention, but nothing worked. The substance was too potent and it acted too quickly. Timothy O'Brien was pronounced dead just 14 minutes after arriving at the hospital and less than an hour after consuming the candy. The immediate assumption was that Timothy had suffered a severe anaphylactic shock or a terrible natural illness. But the doctors noted the strange, potent odor emanating from the child's mouth, a sharp, bitter, almond-like smell. It was the distinct odor of potassium cyanide.
That poor baby.
Which, not everyone can smell the almond from cyanide. It's a genetic trait that causes you to be able to smell it. Yeah, only one out of every 10 people can smell it. Isn't that crazy?
That's just, I just can't get over him doing that to that baby.
Yeah, and it's his own son. And it's a bitter almond smell rather than smelling sweet. Yeah. So back to this. A chemical analysis of the fatal pixie stick later revealed that it contained 645 milligrams of potassium cyanide, which is enough to kill 3 separate adults. The amount was so large that investigators believe the poison must have been intentionally poured into the tube in an industrial dose. So even as Timothy lay dying in the emergency room, Ron O'Brien was already working to cover his tracks. He quickly telephoned the Bates family, urging his neighbor Jim to check his son's candy for the same kind of large pixie stick. He also called the parents of the 2 other brothers he had instructed his neighbors to give the candy to, warning them to destroy the treats immediately. These frantic, targeted calls, made before any official cause of death had been determined, immediately raised the suspicion of hospital staff and eventually the police. The horrifying truth was that O'Brien's plan had nearly succeeded 4 more times. Jim Bates, the neighbor, immediately located the pixie stick and noticed the unusual color of the powder inside and prevented his son from eating it. The father of the 2 brothers that O'Brien had targeted as well was about to give those to his sons as a reward when the call came in. He quickly drove to the police station and handed over the candy. These immediate actions saved the lives of those 4 children. The first candy man had used a lure to betray a community's trust. Our second one here had just used a treat to murder his own son.
That kills me.
On November 5th, 1974, just 5 days after Halloween night, Ronald Clark O'Brien was arrested for the murder of his 8-year-old son, Timothy. The panic that O'Brien had manufactured was immediate and overwhelming. When the initial reports of the poisoned candy came in, police, already sensitive after the Corral fiasco, sent uniformed officers to patrol every street, and the Texas state governor was briefed on the massive scare. The Houston area police chief called the search for the phantom candy giver the most urgent case of his career, demonstrating how effectively Brian had leveraged the city's pre-existing trauma to cover his tracks. Now, the trial of Ronald Clark O'Brien, which began in May of 1975, became a massive media sensation.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
The public, still reeling from the Corral murders just a year earlier, was captivated by the sheer betrayal inherent in this domestic crime. The prosecution meticulously presented the case, the massive secret debt, O'Brien's volatile job history and manipulative character, and the calculated purchase, which was the smoking gun of evidence that argued that Brian had planned to commit a perfect murder, sacrificing his own son in a complex scheme that was only foiled by the vigilance of his neighbors.
Damn, that was 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. The defiance, meanwhile, relied solely on O'Brien's testimony, maintaining the original fabricated story of the phantom candy giver. The most devastating moment for the defense came from the emotional testimony of O'Brien's wife. She was forced to reveal her husband's mounting failures in financial desperation, publicly shattering the image he had so desperately tried to maintain.
See, back in those days, they could a wife could testify against her husband.
Mm-hmm. See, and they still can now, but they can't force you.
Right. Marital hearsay is, I think, is what it's called.
Yeah, there has to be, like, proof to back it up, basically. And they can't force you. The only time they can is if you're an accomplice.
Even then, that's kind of iffy.
Yeah, they still have to have a lot of, and they have to request it from a judge. Judge right. has to sign off, you know, all that. So Brian was visibly unemotional throughout the entire proceedings, often appearing detached and even bored, earning him the immediate public and media nickname, the man who killed Halloween. The jury tasked with deciding the fate of a man who murdered his own child for money deliberated for a remarkably short 90 minutes before returning a verdict of guilty on one count of capital murder and four counts of attempted murder. The swiftness of the verdict reflected the overwhelming circumstantial evidence against him. When the sentence of death was announced, a wave of applause and cheers erupted in the crowded courtroom. A rare and emotional breach of courtroom decorum that spoke to the depth of the community's outrage. So, Ronald Clark O'Brien was sentenced to death.
Good!
Right. A final layer of poetic justice that was delivered when the insurance companies, alerted to the nature of the claim, refused to pay O'Brien the money, efficiently nullifying his entire motive just as the courts were condemning him. He spent the next decade attempting to appeal his sentence. Throughout his years on death row, every single court, from the state level to the federal appeals, upheld his conviction, dismissing his claims of innocence as self-serving and contrary to the overwhelming evidence. His last public display was one of final bitter arrogance. On March 31st, 1984, at the Texas State Penitentiary in Huntsville, Ronald Clark O'Brien was executed by lethal injection. As the execution was carried out...
She gave him the damn cyanide. I'm sorry, I can deal...
I don't mean to laugh. It was the look
I can deal with
face.
A lot of things when a parent murders their own child.
I
that's
just can't wrap my head around it.
I can't either.
I feel like it's a good thing that our heads can't go there, but it's like... I would like to understand.
I don't want to understand. I don't want to know that mindset.
I want... Like, it's... It's more of like what would drive you as a parent to do that is what I want to understand.
As a
like
mother,
how?
I don't know how many times over the years I've threatened to kill my children or my grandchildren. You know
That's
what I'm saying?
Awful.
But I would never go through
right, that. Right.
Because you guys mean more, regardless how nuts you drive me. And I'm talking from your mom and your aunt and your siblings and your cousins and all of the above.
I'll drive you crazy. I'm perfect. What are you talking about?
When you were a kid, you drove me nuts, so you'd be quiet.
I did not. I was a good kid.
I didn't say you weren't a good kid.
I didn't do nothing.
But you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I would die if something was to happen.
Well, every kid drives their parent crazy.
And grandparent.
Right. It's just,
It's nature.
Right, exactly. But, I mean, you can watch animal
but
shows.
But that baby was innocent.
Right, you can watch animal shows, and even animals get annoyed with their kids. Like, it just...
Especially monkeys.
Right, I watched Daxton... No, it was Logan. Because, you know, he's all into animal videos. He was watching something on Netflix, and there was a gorilla, and her baby was in a zoo, or like an enclosure thing. And the baby kept playing with a metal pan and was just banging it on the
ground. Like babies do. Human babies do the same thing.
This is totally like off topic, but she was sitting there and she's like, you know, looking at him like sobbing. She's like, puts her hand up to her head and is like this, and then moves her fingers over to her eyes like this. And then she finally reaches up and she just smacks him. And then he just runs off. And then she lays back and like is trying to take a nap. I don't remember what it was called, but it was hilarious. And I'm like, I feel you.
Yeah, but you know how many
I feel you
human parents have done that?
Right, exactly.
Over the years? Like,
but to
murder
get to
your
the
child.
Point that you feel that money is what you need to do, that's the part that I'm like, I wish.
I can't.
I don't wish I could understand, but I would like to understand, like, how in the world does your brain go there? That's the part that I'm like, I wish I could understand it. How is that? Where is that parental instinct? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't understand it.
You know, and I feel
sorry. I'm glad
sorry.
That my brain doesn't go there, but still.
Yeah, mine too. You got to be a pretty sick person to.
Right. Like, I don't get it. It just, I don't know. Ugh, my knee, sorry.
It just kills me.
Like, I'm glad that my brain can't wrap around it, but at the same time, it's like, what?
Psychologically, I'd like to know.
Right, that's what I meant. That's what I meant, yep.
You know, I'd like to see inside his brain to make why you would do this.
Out of all the decisions you could have made, why did you choose
that? I mean, I'd be more understanding if he did it to his wife.
Still shouldn't do it.
Right, but I'd be more understanding to that
right.
than his child.
Like, yeah. That's
and thank God only one of his children.
Thank God, yeah.
You know?
So, as the execution was carried out, a crowd of over 300 protesters and observers gathered outside the prison gates chanting trick or treat. A chilling testament to the universal hatred and contempt that his crime had inspired. So after O'Brien's arrest, Halloween was never the same.
Oh, yeah.
News anchors couldn't stop repeating the phrase, the Candyman. Parents turned from amused chaperones into anxious inspectors. Hovering under porch lights as their kids dumped out bags of loot. The irony is chilling. Despite the panic, O'Brien's case remains the only confirmed instance of Halloween candy poisoning in American history. Every other tainted candy story since has either been a hoax, a tragic misunderstanding, or an urban legend dressed up as evidence. But fear doesn't need proof. It just needs a story. And O'Brien gave us one that stuck. Now, decades later, checking the candy isn't a paranoia. It's tradition. The myth became ritual. Even parents who don't know his name still reenact his legacy every October 31st, shifting through treats and tossing anything unwrapped, unfamiliar, or suspicious. That's the true reach of Ronald O'Brien's crime. He didn't just take a life. He rewrote an entire holiday. The collective impact of the candy killer was immediate and permanent. O'Brien's calculated use of a holiday tradition to commit murder destroyed the innocence of Halloween nationwide. Before 1974, the biggest fear of Halloween was the lure of a stranger like Dean Correll. After 1974, though, the fear became the treat itself. Parents stopped allowing their children to eat any unwrapped or homemade candy. The ritual of examining every piece of loot for razor blades or needles, which was an exceedingly rare localized concern before 1974, became a mandatory nationwide practice. Because even though, as far as I could find, this is the only documented case where candy has actually been poisoned in American history, there have been other things found. There have been razor blades found in candy.
And fruit and stuff
there
like that.
There have been, like I said earlier, there was a sewing needle found in a fucking Twix bar this year, just a few hours from us. Those things are found every single year. People take pills and wrap it up as if it's candy because there's a lot of pills and medication that look like candy to kids.
Yep.
So, although this is the only incident where there was actually poison put in place of candy, there's other things that do happen every single year. Grocery stores and manufacturers had also reacted. They emphasized tamper-proof, factory-sealed packaging. So the packaging that we see today, obviously it's better.
It ain't, it's adult-proof, not child-proof.
Obviously it's better than what it was then, but this is the case that put those things into effect. This fear also led to the widespread adoption of community case-based candy check programs where fire stations or hospitals would X-ray collected treats for foreign objects, a practice unheard of before O'Brien's crime. Which I don't know if anywhere still does that. I'd never heard of anything like that until this case.
I don't know.
I'd never heard of anything like that. So I
didn't know. Like my trick-or-treat years are over.
Right, right.
You know, so it's been a long time.
So
I don't know.
I've never heard of it. This was O'Brien's ultimate devastating legacy. Though he was executed and the terror of his poisoned treat was largely unfounded after his case, he succeeded in permanently poisoning one of America's most beloved holidays. These two men wore the same sinister moniker, the Candyman, and they left behind a twin legacy of dread. Dean Correll, the first Candyman, shattered the physical trust between a child and neighbor. Ronald Clark O'Brien, the second, destroyed the spiritual trust in a holiday, forever changing the way a parent looks at a simple piece of candy. After the O'Brien case, Halloween in America was never the same. Like I said, even decades later, the shadow of that poisoned pixie stick still lingers. Parents still shift through candy today, searching for that invisible treat. News anchors still run annual segments warning about checking your child's treats. And even though no other confirmed case of Halloween candy being poisoned has ever matched O'Brien's, the fear is still present. Because fear is the easiest to pass down compared to facts. It's become part of a ritual now. The safety lecture before the costume, the bag inspection before bedtime. In a strange way, Ronald Clark O'Brien became the ghost of every Halloween night after 1974. Not just because of what he did, but because of what he made us believe could happen again. It's almost poetic, in a way. In a cruel, uncanny way, in fact, that both of these killers, Dean Correll and Ronald O'Brien, shared the same name. They were two men with radically different motives. One killed for money, the other for power and sadistic pleasure. Yet both were linked by candy and the perversion of innocence. O'Brien represented betrayal within the home, Correll, the predation outside of it. Together, they shared the illusion of safety, turning the idea of Candyman into something archetypal, a stand-in for the way trust itself can be corrupted. Both of these stories force us to look at how evil adapts. It doesn't always wear a mask or carry a weapon in the dark, but sometimes it smiles, offers something sweet, and waits for you to take it. Their names echo through every whispered warning and candy inspection, enduring because we crave understanding. We want to believe that by remembering their crimes, we can keep history from repeating itself. They remind us that safety is never absolute and that monsters rarely vanish. They only change shape, hide behind new faces, and sometimes they still smile when they hand you candy. We began this story asking what makes a monster become a moniker, how a simple, sweet name could become forever synopsis with evil. The answer, as we have seen, is a double tragedy. The history of the Candyman is the story of two men who weaponized the most innocent thing. First, Dean Correll. He used allure to commit atrocities on a scale Houston had never conceived of. Right. He shattered the physical security of a generation, teaching children to fear the invitation from a stranger or worse, from the boy next door. Then, Ronald Clark O'Brien used a treat filled with pure potassium cyanide to commit an act of cold, calculated domestic terror for money. He shattered the spiritual security of a nation, teaching parents to fear the contents of their children's Halloween bags. Together, they left behind that permanent twin legacy of dread. Correll forced America to look outward in fear. O'Brien forced America to look inward for that same fear, realizing that malice can wear the mask of fatherhood. The boogeyman, the phantom, the monster under the bed, they are all stuff of fiction. But the fear of the Candyman is real. It is woven into the DNA of the modern American Halloween. The collective result of their actions is that moment, that universal shared ritual where a parent takes a child's freshly collected Halloween haul and spreads it across the table and methodically checks every piece for razor blades, for holds, for no label. That moment of necessary suspicion is the true lasting monument of the two men who wore that moniker, the Candyman, forever replacing simple joy with an abating caution. Every October, we drape our homes in cobwebs and skeletons, trying to make fear something fun. We carve faces into pumpkins, hang ghosts from porches, and tell ourselves the monsters are pretend, that the darkness can be contained with decorations and laughter. But the real horror stories, the ones that linger long after the jack-o'-lantern burnout, aren't about ghosts or ghouls. They are about people like Ronald Clark O'Brien and Dean Correll, two candymen separated by a year who turned sweetness into something sinister. I've scrolled up by accident. Their names echo through every whispered warning, every candy inspection, every nervous glance a parent gives their child's trick-or-treat haul. They turned Halloween into something complicated, a mix of thrill and threat, celebration and suspicion. Stories like theirs remind us that real horror doesn't hide under the bed or behind that mask. It hides in the most familiar places, in the neighbor's smile, and the promise of something harmless, and the trust that we give too easily. And maybe that's why we continue to tell these stories, because deep down, we don't just crave the scare, we crave the understanding. We want to believe that by naming the monster, by speaking its story out loud, we can keep it from coming back. So, as the candles flicker out, streets go quiet, you have to remember this. Monsters rarely vanish. They simply change shape. They hide behind new faces, and sometimes they still smile when they hand you the candy. And so, the legacy lives on. Whether you hear the name Candyman in a whisper of a dark movie screen, in a dark, quiet bathroom, or read it on the cold pages of a Texas homicide report, you are summoning a ghost of betrayal. Because of them, the simple, joyous custom of trick-or-treating became a calculation of risk. And the phrase spoken every October 31st took on a sinister, phoratic meaning, trick-or-treat. The choice they proved could sometimes be a matter of life or death. And with that, we close out our book on the twin tragedies of the Candyman and the official conclusion of our spooky season run.
There were some sick puppies.
Yep. Originally, I was only going to do Ronald Clark O'Brien, but then I found the first one. And you can't do one without the other, in my opinion.
Yeah, because the first one kind of sets the other one.
Right. It kind of sets the scene for the fear that was already there.
Right.
Yeah. And it's Halloween, so let's close it out on a double episode.
Now we can concentrate on Christmas.
Yeah.
Oh, Thanksgiving, then Christmas.
Yeah, I've got a couple for Thanksgiving. I have one for Thanksgiving, sorry. The other ones are just kind of happened about this time of year, you know? Yep, we've got some good ones coming up for
fall season.
Fall and Christmas. Close out the year.
Well, hopefully Mandy will be back by then.
Hopefully, we'll see. Got so much going on up there. It's ridiculous.
I know.
But yep, that's it for this one.
That was worth my heart.
Yeah. I know it always seems like I'm just like nonchalant about any of it. Whereas you and Mandy are always like, what the fuck? You know? But I research it. I read through it. Type it up. I read through it like two or three more times after that to make sure that it's good and okay. I don't need to change anything. So by the time we record it, I know what's going to happen. So those same reactions that you guys have, I've already had.
Yeah, but it's already fun. It's more funnier when we do it, though. Right.
I've already had them.
Yeah.
So because I know what's coming.
It don't bother you as bad.
Right. Like it does, but I'm able to, because I know it's coming. So I know it always seems like I'm cold.
You know, being a mother and a grandmother and a great grandmother.
Right.
Hearing these stories of the boys And then that little, then the father killing,
yep,
killing that little boy. That just killed, that just breaks my heart.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I'd have never even thunk.
Right.
Of doing that.
Yep.
Not in a million years.
This one is one of the ones that I've had that it took me a little bit longer to write than the other ones.
With being a mother.
Right, because it's a lot. And that's where I found when I started watching the Call the Midwife show was because I'm like, I need a break.
I need a palate cleanser.
Right, exactly. I need something that is not this, because this is a lot.
Yeah.
And so I started watching that. And so that's why I've been doing. I'll work on a case and then I'll watch a few episodes of that to just decompress from it all.
Right.
It's all, especially these ones like this. Now, I have had a couple episodes where it's taken me a minute to get through reading it because it's been
so horrific.
It's been a lot. Yeah. It's been a lot that I've had to get through. And so that's why I know I sound unemotional about it, cold and callous, and I don't mean to be.
Oh, and I know you're not.
Right. I don't mean to be, which that's why I'm telling it. I don't mean to be at all. I've went through it so many different times. I know what's coming. And so I guess it doesn't affect me in that moment as it would you or Mandy or any of the listeners, because I wrote it, I've researched all of it. And that's the hardest part, is reading it and figuring out, okay, how am I going to write this and present it so that way it's, you can deal with it, I guess, without lack of a better term, you can deal with it and it not be too much, you know?
Right, right.
Because we have...
You know what to expect.
Right, and I tried to do it in a way, because we have, at the beginning, the listener discretion, because some cases you just can't do that with. But I try, when I write them, I try to do my best to make it to where it's not way too much and not too hard.
Listener friendly.
Right. I do my best to do that. Even with the topics that we do, I really try to do that. Because it is a lot. Some of them are very, ugh. So, but anyway, yep. That's all we have, guys. Just wanted to insert that in there. I don't want anybody to think that.
I guess monsters do come in all shapes and sizes. Mm-hmm.
I learned that from Scooby-Doo, man. Hey, who said Scooby-Doo didn't teach lessons? Okay, I learned as a kid, the real monsters are the people. That's what Scooby-Doo taught me. Because in Scooby-Doo, every time there was a monster, it was a person, not a monster.
No, I know. I used to sit and watch Scooby-Doo with you.
I loved me some Scooby-Doo. Okay, guys. With all of that, we will be back on Monday. So back to only on Mondays every week. If these chilling stories change the way you looked at Halloween, if you learned something this season, or if you enjoyed these spooky seasons in general, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Both of these things help us bring more deep dives just like this one right to you and helps bring new listeners to us. You can check us out on Facebook. That link is in our description. You can also send us an email for any case suggestions, personal listener tales, anything like that. You can send all those to our email, which is also in our episode description. You can also check us out on TikTok. So with all of that, we hope everyone had a great Halloween and spooky season. And we will be back on Monday. So we hope you keep listening. And remember to
watch out for monsters.
And don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.